Next case is Richard Carlson versus the Merit Systems Protection Board, 073071. Welcome back, Mr. Porter.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. Nice to be back. Well, glad to see friends of the board are here. Patent law is sometimes arcane to me, but the MSPB has its points of interest too. And one of those is the enforcement procedures used by the board to deal with settlement agreements. The board is very clear, Your Honors, on the time limits for filing petitions for review with the board, just as you are with filing petitions or appeals with this court. And the regulations are also extremely clear on the time limit for initiating an appeal with the board. The board has often dismissed cases that are only late by a day or so. But in the enforcement side, the regulation is far from clear. The board's regulation on enforcement deals with basically two types of orders. One is a decision on the merits by the board, so-called final decision. That's where the person has won the case. They're seeking some type of remedy that they don't receive automatically from the agency. They go into an enforcement or a compliance procedure. The second is with respect to settlements. A lot of cases, 50% of the board's caseload is settled, more or less, of those that aren't dismissed for jurisdictional timeliness reasons. So there are a lot of settlements, and these settlements are closed out by initial decisions, and with a lapse of 35 days after the initial decision, the decision becomes a final decision. And then the fun begins, because what happens is the settlements break down. People don't necessarily do what they intended to do or thought they intended to do at the time they settled.
And isn't the test here a reasonable time, and isn't that a matter of discretion?
There's lots of discretion involved, but the legal test is a little bit more complex. The regulatory provision requires that the enforcement petition be filed promptly. Promptly is not defined in the regulation. The enforcement petition is measured in terms of promptness under the case law, both the board and this court. And that case law does not track the type of decisions you find that are rejecting appeals and petitions for review is untimely. Instead, another measure is used. And that measure has been announced by this court in the case upon which we rely principally, and that's the case of Poet. That was a decision that injected into the equation as an element.
Counsel, didn't Kosarsky before Poet?
Yes.
My chronology is right. And in Kosarsky, we said unreasonable delay, a reasonable time period.
Yes.
And we never mentioned anything about material prejudice or any of that.
No.
So the test, as set by Kosarsky, was a reasonable time. Now, if I understand your argument, you're saying Poet changed that?
No. Poet didn't change it. Poet added definition. Because you get back to the basic question of what's a reasonable time? What's prompt? What's reasonable? Well, the answer is it's discretionary. Well, fine. If it's a completely discretionary test, then we're out of court.
Well, it depends on the circumstances.
Of course.
And that's what Kosarsky said.
That's exactly so.
And then within that framework, then the discretion is exercised.
Exactly.
Or is necessary.
And 2 years later, along comes Poet versus our friends at the MSPB, another enforcement timeliness issue, where the court says, Kosarsky says reasonableness, and the way we're going to interpret reasonableness is we're going to draw an analogy to the doctrine of laches. And the court comes right out and says what laches involves. Now, I don't know much about patent law, but I learned a little bit aside from occasional references to this court, to file wrapper estoppel, which will remain with me forever, to the doctrine of laches, which seems to be well entrenched in the patent litigation before this court. It's a concept which seems to find some repetitive dealings with this, to these courts' opinions in the patent law.
But Poet didn't equate reasonableness with laches.
What Poet said, Your Honor, it didn't say reasonableness is laches. It says that it's conceptually similar to the defense of laches. And then when
it in context, it simply made reference to the fact that in a laches test, you have both a determination of reasonableness and a determination of prejudice.
Yes, sir.
It didn't say that, therefore, the reasonableness determination following Kozarski encompasses also a prejudice test.
I would not read it that way, Your Honor. When I looked at Kozarski compared it with the Poet case, in the Poet case, the defendant is supposed to show that the plaintiff delayed filing the lawsuit, talking about patent cases perhaps, but analogizing it to an appeal or an enforcement proceeding in the MSPB, for an unreasonable and inexcusable length of time from the time that he knew or should have known of the claim, and that the delay operated to the prejudice of the defendant.
But that's what the court says is the definition of the laches defense. But then the very next line after they define it is, in either case, and I assume you agree with me that what they mean is, in either case, i.e. a petition for enforcement of settlement, or in the laches context, unreasonable delay is needed. They don't say in either case both prongs are needed. They said in either case, the first prong of the laches defense and unreasonable time is needed for a petition.
Yes, and Your Honor, court, please, I believe that is a component of the doctrine of laches. You don't get to the question of defense prejudice until you show the plaintiff unreasonably delayed. If the plaintiff didn't unreasonably delay, don't worry about defense prejudice. It's only when there is an unreasonable and inexcusable delay, and then you worry about defense prejudice.
But how does that statement in Poet read a prejudice requirement into the reasonableness requirement following Kozarski?
I can't read it any other way. If the court says we're going to treat reasonableness under a laches approach, which is the court said.
No, it said it's conceptually similar.
Yes, it's conceptually similar.
We're going to treat it under a laches approach. It says it's conceptually similar. Maybe they were talking about the conceptual similarity between the first prong of laches.
It's possible, like you said before, it's very hard for me to read into the mind of somebody else. All I can read is what's on the paper. And if the court in Poet, in a civil service case, starts talking about laches, then I think that determines the course of the law for the Merit Systems Protection Board. I can't figure out exactly what the court might otherwise have meant, but they injected the concept of laches into a civil service.
Unreasonable delay is needed. That's what they say in the very next sentence.
Yes, unreasonable.
Unreasonable delay is a requirement of both.
Unreasonable and inexcusable length of time from the time the person knew that something had gone awry with the settlement agreement. That is my reading. I believe those are the words of the public case. So when I look at that, it appears to me that the court is suggesting, and this is not the first time they brought laches into a civil service case, but it is the first time that I've seen laches applied in an enforcement proceeding. There are other types of cases where laches has arisen in this court in the context of civil service cases. This is completely novel. But it is the first time I saw it here. Now, this is what 2004 was the Poet case. And I haven't seen any decision since that time from the court that has gone to say, oh, we really didn't mean laches, we meant something else, we're going to retreat to some other type of formulation here. Not any precedential decision in any event, no non-precedential decision that I can recall that I can cite here under the court's rules. So my reading of Poet injects an element of laches. If the court is to say that's not to be the case, then that's not to be the case. But I think it's a reasonable approach, rather than the usual extremely strict approach by the board with respect to the filing of appeals that have a regulatory deadline and the filing of petitions for review. These settlement agreements constitute best benefits that have been negotiated. The board has not chosen to redo its regulation, to make that regulation more clear. The regulation that the board uses for these enforcement cases is extremely unclear. It does not define what's reasonable. It doesn't even define whether an agency is supposed to file a certificate of compliance when a settlement has been entered into an initial decision. Now, the board has held in one case that that's not required. I think some agencies do and some agencies probably don't. There is nothing in the board's regulations that that further defines the term here, and there's nothing in the board's regulation that even tells a pro se appellant, as my client, Mr. Carlson, was at the time, how in the world you're supposed to challenge a problem with a settlement agreement. How do you set aside an agreement? You bring an enforcement petition. That's counterintuitive. It's not something that's explained in the regulations. So my client did the best he could at the time. When he learned of this extraordinary defamatory memorandum from the very man who had just signed the settlement agreement the day before, Mr. Hood, the very man who had signed the decision to fire this fellow sometime before the board appealed, my client immediately, not a year later, a day later, wrote an email to the administrative judge of the Merit Systems Protect Board, a highly respected judge, and said, this is not right. Is this a breach of the settlement agreement? Now, there are a few things that judge could have done. He could have ignored the email, which he did not. He could have responded to it by saying, go talk to your lawyer, which is what he did. Or he could have said, you know, you have a problem here. Why don't you bring an enforcement proceeding and take a look at 5 CFR 1201.181 and 182, which he did not. And I don't mean to yell, by the way, but I do get excited occasionally about these cases. The judge should have told this man what to do, and he did. As a result...
We've had some real yells, and that's not one.
As a result, he goes off on this long campaign to rectify the wrong. Goes to the inspector general of the agency, gets into district court in Chicago on a Privacy Act lawsuit.
You know, if the AJ had tried to interpret the email that your client said, admittedly he's not a lawyer, and told him something is wrong here, this is what you should do, that's what you want AJs to do,
absolutely,
to reach out and to give legal advice about how a client ought to proceed. And then what, are we going to hold him responsible, the AJ, that is, if he doesn't advise them of every possible thing he might be able to do, bring a district court litigation, or do this, or do that? I mean, it just seems to me that, quite honestly, the AJ did it exactly right here. They informed him to contact his lawyer. He had a lawyer at that point. He wasn't unrepresented by counsel. It was appropriate for the AJ to say, I can't address this, it's improper, you need to consult your lawyer.
I, with all due respect, Your Honor, I disagree.
You want the AJ to give legal advice to one party in the litigation?
I want the AJ to give regulatory advice anytime they're dealing with a pro se or other individual. Is there a charge by law?
Wasn't he represented by a lawyer then?
He was. If you read his affidavit, he and his lawyer had essentially parted ways. Remember, the case had settled. The way practice of law works with the MSPB, you define a particular scope of work and you move on as a lawyer. The case is settled, and that's the scope of your representation. You're done. And sometimes lawyers don't want to undo settlements. Think about it for a second. As a lawyer, you just received substantial counsel fees. You undo that settlement, what happens to those counsel fees? There are reasons why these things happen. They're not necessarily the record.
So you expected the AJ to know he was no longer represented by counsel and to give legal advice?
The AJ
is, the AJ to know.
The AJ is responsible, and I think my colleagues at the MSPB would agree if you were to ask them, for advising people of the procedures that they're supposed to follow in these cases. And this court has so held. Many times, this court has sent cases back to the board saying the AJ should have advised the individual of a particular right or remedy or procedure to follow and not remain silent. That is the AJ's responsibility. Do they give legal advice and turn into surrogate counsel? They do not. But there's a huge difference between remaining silent on an important procedural matter. A person comes to a judge and says, the settlement agreement has been violated, is a breach. In my estimation, the board's may be different. The judge has a responsibility to say, file a petition for enforcement. Read 5 CFR 1201.181 to 182. And in my estimation, the judge was not fully responsible to his duties by failing to do that and set this fellow off on this long travail that ended up here with me arguing lashes because of the Poet case.
Mr. Brody, you're in your rebuttal time. Would you like to save it or?
I shall desist. Thank you.
We'll give you your full 3 minutes. I'll hear from the government, Ms. Friedman. Let me caution, Mr. Carlson, with that is, Mr. Carlson, I noticed you nodding your head and raising your hand. You speak through your counsel. If you have anything to say, Mr. Breuer has your vote. Ms. Friedman.
May it please the court, Mr. Carlson's attempt to use latches as a reason to accept his untimely petition is indeed a strange construct of how latches is normally used in the law. It is an affirmative defense, an equitable defense used against a petitioner bringing a lawsuit to bar the petition because of unreasonable delay and because of prejudice to the defending party. Here, Mr. Carlson is the petitioner and is not bringing up latches as a defense.
You're saying there's no such thing as reverse latches?
Not in any case that I could come across. And in fact, in a footnote in my brief, in footnote 3, I made an analogy to the writ of quorum nobis. And in that area, also, there's no set time limit. And the Second Circuit in that case found that latches was also brought up as a basis to accept a late petition. And the standard there was also a reasonable amount of time in which to bring the petition, and the court said, no, you can't do this. So I've never seen latches used in this way. It is an equitable defense. And Mr. Carlson's construct eviscerates the term in the board's regulation that a party must promptly file a petition for enforcement. Now, Mr. Carlson's argument that the equitable defense of latches replaces the standard that a party must file within a reasonable time after actual knowledge of an alleged breach is untenable. The fact that the court and poet stated that the concepts are conceptually similar merely meant that unreasonableness is the same element that you would find in a case that is barred by latches and in a case where a petition for enforcement is dismissed as untimely.
Mr. Carlson did act promptly in contacting the AJ, didn't he?
He did act promptly in contacting the AJ, but if you look at the email message that he sent to the AJ, it's not clear, like Mr. Boyder just said, that he was saying that, oh, I wish to file a petition for enforcement. In fact, it was filed before the finality date, a month before the finality date of the initial decision. And Mr. Carlson had clear instructions just the day before in the initial decision on how to file a petition for enforcement and how to file a petition for review. He thought that the settlement agreement should be nulled.
And then he waited a year?
And then he waited a year. And the response that the AJ gave to the email clearly indicated that the administrative judge did not consider.
When did the AJ respond in relation to Mr. Carlson's response to the email? Or was it close to when he filed the petition for enforcement?
He filed almost immediately a response to the email saying, well, you know, this decision is not final. This would be an ex parte communication. The response clearly showed that the administrative judge had no idea that he was even attempting to file a petition for enforcement, or he would have maybe sent out a show cause order saying, is this what you're trying to do?
But there was no. So that relates to reasonableness. Mr. Carlson waited a year. You're saying that was unreasonable?
Yes.
And that was within the board's discretion?
Yes, absolutely. As I started to say, that I think that when the court and the poet was making an analogy to latches, the fact that they followed up the analogy in saying that reasonableness is what's common in both kinds of cases, they could have said right after that, and also we also think that prejudice to the agency should also be considered. But the court didn't do that. They just focused in on the unreasonableness of the delay.
So you don't think the AJ should have told him then, as Mr. Carlson's counsel suggested, exactly what procedures he should have used in the email.
Well, the AJ, in fact, did tell him.
The day before?
Yes, he told him the very day before in the initial decision. It was a very clear instruction on what he had to do to file his petition for enforcement and what he had to do to file a petition for review if he thought that there was mutual mistake or that the agreement should be void ab initio. So,
and you don't think after receiving Mr. Carlson's email, it would have been fair to suggest that the AJ should have known that Mr. Carlson needed further advice or notice at that point in time?
No, and actually the email stated, unlike what Mr. Carlson said later on, that my attorney
I was going to ask him about that on the boat.
My attorney and I think that this is a real violation of the Privacy Act, and it may very well null the settlement agreement. What is your opinion? That's not here. I'm filing a petition for enforcement because I think that the agreement has been breached. That's far from that. So the administrative judge had no idea, and I think he handled responding to Mr. Carlson just right. Now, the administrative judge, I think, correctly found that Mr. Carlson did not file his petition for enforcement within a reasonable amount of time after he became aware of the alleged breach. And he became aware of the alleged breach on February 26th. He did not file a petition for enforcement until a year later.
But he pursued it. I think he just didn't know what to do, right? I mean, because he obviously pursued this. He filed an inspector general investigation. He filed a number of other things.
Yes.
He just didn't get the right one within your time period. But, I mean, it's obvious he tried to pursue it and he didn't know where to file.
Well, pursuit in other forums, this court and the board has decided to be not a good reason to not file with the board, especially when you get such clear, unambiguous instruction on filing with the petition for enforcement. I might also add that Mr. Carlson was not an unsophisticated pro se appellant. He was represented by an attorney that frequently appears before the board. There is evidence in the record that says that he consulted with Mr. Passman, his previous attorney, about what he should do. He consulted with many different attorneys to see how to proceed with a Privacy Act, what he should do. So this is not a case where he's a poor pro se that doesn't know anything and that has never consulted with an attorney. So I think that his reasons do not evidence that his delay was reasonable. Now, the other reason that he gave to the board to...
Are there any regulations that expound upon how the MSPB comes to a conclusion of whether delay is or is not reasonable?
Well, yes, they're in fact, in the very regulation that this case stems from, 1201.182, gives a 30-day time deadline if you are filing a petition for enforcement from an order of the board. And Pizarski and Poet, the panels said, we can draw some instruction from the regulation, we can draw some parallels. And I think that in the case of an order, when a petitioner files his petition for enforcement, he does not have to show good cause for the delay if the agency doesn't give him notice that they complied. But in the case of a settlement agreement, of course, there's a presumption that the agency is going to comply. The regulation says that good cause is what you must show to excuse a delay if you do get that notice. And I think that that's instructive in seeing the circumstances of this case and looking at the factors that go into what makes up good cause for a delay could be used in this case as well. And I think that even using those factors, there's nothing in this case to indicate that his delay was reasonable. The final thing that I'd like to add is that one of the reasons he gave for his delay was that he was severely depressed. And I have to point out that the depression, as you suggested, did not prohibit him from consulting with other attorneys, from quickly cashing his back paycheck that the agency gave him in settlement. It didn't prevent him from going to other forums. It didn't prevent him from going and filing a Privacy Act appeal in the district court. So, thus, based on the reasonableness standard, time standard in Pizarski and Poet, we respectfully submit that the board's decision should be affirmed. And if there are no other questions, I will rest on my brief.
Thank you, Ms. Friedman. Mr. Joyner will give you your 3 minutes.
Thank you. My good friend, Ms. Friedman, has made a few points to which I will offer a brief response. As to the so-called clarity of the board's enforcement process, what the initial decision said at page 51 of our appendix was that the settlement agreement has been made part of the record if you believe there has not been full compliance with the terms of the agreement. After this initial decision becomes final, you can ask the board to enforce the agreement by filing a petition for enforcement with the office. It doesn't say anything about what happens if he believes that the agreement has been breached to the point where it's a nullity. The instructions given, again, it's counterintuitive. How do you enforce an agreement by making it go away? That's not explained except in the board's case law. For a pro se appellant, that's a very difficult concept. It's difficult enough for lawyers. As to the question of advice of counsel, again, in our appendix, I'm not here to try the facts, but I will recite the record. At page 55 of our appendix is Mr. Carlson's affidavit, where he explains at the second full paragraph of page 55 the difficulty with his prior counsel. He and his prior counsel essentially separated ways at the time that settlement agreement was filed. And after that, his prior counsel did not want to get involved in breach issues. From the standpoint of counsel, that may be perfectly understandable. From the standpoint of the client, it's very difficult because it places the individual, that's page 55, it places the individual in a very difficult position. And as to the notice to Judge Ann Sorge, one day after the settlement, about one day prior to the issuance of the initial decision accepting the settlement, he's writing to Ann Sorge, the administrative judge. He says, I'm forwarding a copy of the letter, this is page 52 of the appendix, that was distributed in the agency regarding myself. My attorney and I believe it to be a blatant violation of the Privacy Act and that it may null the settlement agreement reached. I would be most interested in your opinion. Again, in my estimation, what the judge should have said, you have a problem, file an enforcement proceeding to set this agreement aside. Or the judge might also have said, you have a problem. I haven't accepted this agreement into the record yet because the judge had not. His initial decision did not issue, as near as I can figure it, until about a day after that email. He could have held up the whole process to check it out. That's what might have been. That's not what occurred. I think my client did the best he could under the circumstances. Board's law is very punitive on appeals and petitions for review. If day wait, you're out of the board very frequently. Lots of case law on that, unfortunately. It's a much more forgiving standard with respect to enforcement. It's a much less clear procedure. And my belief is that if this circuit has injected the law of latches into this type of analysis, then it should have been followed. And that was brought to the attention of the administrative judge and the board below. I thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Boyd. The case will be taken under advisement.